Welcome to New World Notes. This is Kenneth Doust, and today we'll look at why America's public schools are as bad as they are. I just added it up, and it's scary. I've spent 36 years in the field of education, from kindergarten through a PhD, then 12 years teaching college. Given this shady background, it's remarkable how little time the show is spent on the subject of education. We did have Professor James Lowen discussing how god-awful and false American history textbooks are, and twice we've heard George Carlin's theory of why schools are as bad as they are, namely, because the ruling elite wants them that way.
There's a reason education sucks, and it's the same reason that it will never, ever, ever be fixed. Because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now. The real owners, the big wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. You know something? They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table and figure out how badly they're getting f***ed by a system that threw them overboard 30 years ago. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers. People who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly shittier jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money.
Now I've discovered John Taylor Gatto. He's a brilliant guy, an award-winning school teacher, a published author of nonfiction, and a brilliant historian and theorist of education. He's won two Teacher of the Year awards, one from New York City, the other from New York State. Soon after receiving the latter, he quit teaching school and devoted himself to trying to convince the public that American public schools are not failing. Rather, they're succeeding admirably in accomplishing their real goals. Exploitative evil goals created not by the teachers or even by the education professors, but by the ruling elite. That is, in 20,000 words, Gatto makes exactly the same points that George Carlin made in 200. Of course, I'm being unfair to Gatto. Carlin just speaks generalizations, take them or leave them. Gatto gives details. He explains things. He discusses how and why schools are the way they are, what particular people made them that way, and where they got their ideas from. The answer to that last question is Germany, by the way, specifically Prussia. The same country, I may add, that invented kindergarten, the PhD degree, and World War II. So if you've ever called your teacher a fascist or your principal, you may have been closer to the mark than you realized. So think of Gatto as elaborating on Carlin. But Gatto goes one step further. It's not that public schools were fine in the 1940s and 50s and have since declined. Rather, they worked, and failed to work, just as they do today from the very beginning of compulsory public education, about one century ago. In 2003 or 2004, Gatto gave a great and very long talk on this matter. We'll hear the first third of that talk today, condensed further by me. In the middle of it, we'll take a break for a song about public education. And no, it's not Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall. Fooled you! Gatto starts by reflecting on Roy Kroc and McDonald's hamburgers.
Now, over 50% of all the restaurant profit in America goes to places like McDonald's and Domino's. And they control pretty much the potato business, the beef business, the onion, ketchup, and mustard world. They're the second largest distributor of toys in the world, and lots of other things. That entire industry, the largest employer in America, was completely built and developed by high school dropouts and otherwise unschooled or lightly schooled individuals. If you read Fast Food Nation, it's an eye-opener. This gigantic global industry was created exclusively by high school dropouts, not a single college degree in the bunch. Now think what that means, a hefty chunk of our gross national product was invented out of thin air by enterprising young people who went on to provide work for college graduates, MBAs, accountants, ad agencies, hotshots, and so on. That's intriguing, isn't it? The bad part is that the food is filthy and even dangerous. And here's what Iacocca said down there in Argentina in 1993. I'm bothered by the memory of what happened in Germany. This is Lee speaking. Education was put forward there, too, as the solution to unemployment, and the result was hundreds of thousands of frustrated professionals who then turned to socialism and rebellion. I wonder if it wouldn't be better for the unemployed to smarten up and go straight to McDonald's to find a job. The idea that people who know too much are dangerous is an old one, of course, but it isn't something that American leaders allow themselves to talk about in the open. So Iacocca must have felt himself on very safe ground down there at the end of the world, safe enough to flaunt a little reckless honesty. For if education isn't the answer in Argentina, it's fair to say it wouldn't be the answer in California either. The number one civilian job in the United States is working for a fast food chain, and nobody would be silly enough to argue that that takes much of an education. In fact, if you went down the list of the country's top 10 jobs as published every year by the Labor Department and its predicted top 10 for the next decade, you'd see that education doesn't play a vital hand in many of them. In fact, in any of them, from some perspectives, it only gets in the way. Add that together with Iacocca's warning that educated people are dangerous, and you have all you need to come to terms with the dumbing down of American schools. Somebody thinks it's a safeguard against, what did Iacocca call it? Rebellion. This idea that America's corporate leadership has an adversarial outlook on ordinary citizenry is an unsettling notion. In the absence of no more information than Lee Iacocca's sneaky remark in Argentina, I'd be inclined to discourage you from harboring any suspicions that America's children are being held in captivity and dumbed down in some colossal experiment to train consumers early, even if stupid, childish people are better customers for poop-filled hamburgers than educated ones. But unfortunately, Iacocca's reckless remark is not the only clue we have that something is afoot. I first got wind that childishness might have a political function from James Bryan Conan, president of Harvard for 30 years, high commissioner of Germany after World War II, a top executive on the atomic bomb project, and the father of the comprehensive high school in America, a big fish in any pond. Conant led me to the actual purposes of forced schooling in 20th century America, but before we find out what they are, I need to get the important idea of boredom established and out of the way. As a school teacher, I came to discover that American secondary schools are places of exquisite boredom on purpose. The only people who escape are those with a highly developed inner life. But you can't have a highly developed inner life unless you have a historical dimension and an artistic dimension and a philosophical dimension and a number of other inner states that are thoroughly discouraged by the training of schools. Schools are laboratories of extended childishness. Even the advanced classes are maddeningly childish, and as significant as the boredom of young people is the poorly concealed fact that teachers in these institutions are bored too. Their dispirited speech, their low energy, and their constant whining is the giveaway. If you ask school kids why they're bored, they always give the same few answers. They say the work is stupid, that it makes little sense, that they already know it. They say they want to be doing something important, not just sitting around. The teachers themselves aren't interested in what they teach, and that in any case, they don't know very much. And when you ask school teachers the same question, why they're bored, they say it's the kids' fault. The kids are rude. They aren't interested in anything but grades. So how can a teacher be interested? It's a catch-22, you see. Anyone who looks at schools closely with an open mind and a sense of proportion becomes aware what childish places they are, how many kids and even teachers are held prisoner in a childhood they would willingly leave if they knew how and if the institution permitted it. The palette of childishness includes selfishness, irresponsibility, boredom, envy, inconsiderate behavior, whining, cowardice, at least frequently, and in general, a lack of emotional proportion and self-discipline. Childish people need to be attended to by adults. That's important, so don't forget it. It's an important clue to what's really going on. We have an institutional structure which finds itself compelled to suppress those very qualities which are universally acknowledged to be passports of success in Western society. Schools ask kids to remain childlike well beyond its natural term, but if they can't get childlike, they will settle for its toxic cousin, childish. The most radical thing I have to say to you, I'm going to say now, this has not gone on for a century without it serving some rational purpose. Remember, rationality and reasonableness are two different things. I know you think schools are unreasonable, so do I. But that is a far cry from proving them irrational, and you'll see what I mean as we proceed.
Our blood runs blue. We're loyal men and true. The hope of a new generation. But we don't speak too well. We can't read or add or spell. California couldn't pay our education. Wall, resplendent in squalid privation. And our texts were first rate back in 1958. California couldn't pay our education. And 3 years on, when they noticed we were gone, they showered us with consideration. And they transferred our files to the Hall of Juveniles. California couldn't pay our education.
We had a great music teacher, but he got laid off.
Now we've got great jobs.
I stocked the salad bar at Bob's.
And I polished knobs at Union State. la, 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 la.
California couldn't pay our education. The proprietor of our local liquor store refused our request for a donation. But we changed his mind with a crowbar from behind. California couldn't pay our education. They locked us away for 3 years and a day, completing our alienation. But we learned from those men how to not get caught again. California finally paid our education.
That was the Four Men, a group that included Roy Zimmerman, singing a song about three men who dropped out of public school because of its appalling conditions. They didn't do as well in the world as the founder of McDonald's, but they did learn a trade. Let's recap. Gatto shows that, one, for most of the actual jobs available, little or no school education actually is needed. Two, captains of industry and other rulers, like Lee Iacocca and James B. Conant, warned that a public that is universally well-educated, knowledgeable, independent, and critical thinking is dangerous to the interests of the ruling elite. Germany, and particularly Prussia, pioneered a system of public education designed to make the public obedient, malleable, and below the level of independent, functioning adults. The state could then finish the people as needed. Usually it needed soldiers. In the United States, the captains of finance and industry adapted these ideas. They wanted citizens turned into obedient, loyal workers, dependent, childlike personalities accustomed to doing what the adults told them to do, and most of all, consumers, whose opinions could easily be manipulated so that the factory wheels kept turning and the profits kept flowing upwards. They wanted to be free from Adam Smith's law of supply and demand, by shaping the demand, by making citizens passive, fuzzy-thinking, trend-following, childlike, or childish consumers who always look to authority to tell them how to behave and what to think. They wanted to transform a nation of hardy, independent farmers and tradesmen into a nation of passive, obedient factory workers and passive, obedient consumers. To accomplish this, they revolutionized the American educational system and created universal, mandatory, state-funded schooling. And son of a gun, it worked. In part two today, Gatto discusses the latter several points. He talks about how unusual universal compulsory education is, how the Prussians created a managed people to serve a managed economy and a managed society, how America is doing the same to serve an economy based on consumerism, and how prolonging childhood and fostering dependency are key aspects in the American system of public indoctrination.
Secondary school wasn't the only way to grow up until after 1945. We tend to forget that. Indeed, even 10 years after 1945, the fast food dropout geniuses I talked about earlier were putting together a profound new way of life for all of us without benefit of diplomas or degrees. Even today in wealthy Switzerland, less than one kid in four goes beyond elementary school. If you knew that, would you raise your hand? How come no one bothered to tell you that three out of four kids, more than that, in Switzerland, don't go beyond elementary school? You did hear, as I did yesterday and the day before, that Switzerland has just announced that one out of every 39 of its citizens are millionaires in terms of cash. One out of 39 Swiss are millionaires, including many, many people who only have an elementary school education. The school journalists and pedagogues in America haven't bothered to tell you about Switzerland. That in itself is a paradox, don't you think? For most of our own history, most kids did not go to secondary school. Yet the unschooled rose to be admirals like Farragut, inventors like Edison, captains of industry like Carnegie and Rockefeller, presidents like Washington and Lincoln, writers like Herman Melville, or scholars like Margaret Mead. People who reached age 13 were not looked upon as children. The United States had a successful system of education before we got forced institutional schooling. Then why were the training grounds in boredom we call public schools demanded as a replacement? Even the simple matter of physically confining children, immobilizing them, is known to cause damage to health even in the short run, and it sets up negative patterns which tend to persist lifelong. Why was this done? Prussia, about two centuries ago, by 1820, Prussia was teaching the rest of the world that schools could be efficient training grounds for a managed economy and a managed society. Now, I know some of you say, well, we don't have a managed economy. This is a free market. And I'll accept that from you if you can explain to me why Lockheed can go bankrupt and rise back to life again on the back of your tax money, or why Chrysler can go bankrupt and rise back to health with your tax money as a direct subsidy to it. I could go on for quite a long time about the corporations that haven't been able to compete that are still parts of your daily life. If school could create obedient political subjects, incomplete people, that's the key, incomplete people that the state could finish and adjust as it saw fit. Now, that was Prussia. The mechanism to perform this magic was habit training, sensitizing children to be reflexively responsive to propaganda. How well this scheme worked to concentrate state power, the world was soon to learn in three titanic Prussian-inspired wars between 1871 and 1945. And quite apart from its war-enhancing ability, Prussian habit control schooling served the emerging mass production business empires just coming into being. Early on, German psychology saw that school conditioning could make children susceptible to any sort of authoritarian appeal, including those soft core authoritarianisms of advertising and public relations. A few brilliant minds saw what was at stake. Nothing less than a way to overturn Adam Smith's implacable laws of supply and demand. If demand could reliably be created for anything and any idea, a managerial revolution would be at hand. In my own recent memory, the most flagrant example of this is the so-called Iraqi War, which 3 weeks before it began was repudiated by the majority of the American population, a strong majority of the American population, by 62%. And then, with the help of your tax money and mine, an enormous public relations machine was set in motion, and 3 weeks later, a bare majority of the population was in favor of an attack on Iraq. If opinion could be created, I wanted to give you an example of what I'm talking about here. Managers would be free of the tyranny of public opinion. It could be whatever management wanted, in theory at least. With this in mind, and inspired by Asian successes in crowd management brought back to the United States by traders and by dealers in opium, the founders of compulsory schooling aimed from the beginning to collectivize and socialize, there's a word you hear, isn't it, the ordinary population through the inculcation of the habits and attitudes of dependency. Put simply, they worked to extend childhood well beyond its natural limits by arranging for the removal of young people from home and neighborhood surroundings, from adult company, from real responsibility, and then placing them with total strangers, false kin, for the best part of the day. As schools grew larger and remote bureaucracies selected both teaching personnel and curriculum sequences, it was not uncommon for parents to know nothing at all about the people assigned to be the main companions of their offspring. A situation which would have been regarded as fantastic madness or flagrant tyranny for most of our recorded history was now imposed as a daily routine. And to deepen the estrangement, the teachers only appeared to be central figures in this equation. I could say the teachers, the principals, and the superintendents. Actually, they and their own nominal superiors were themselves under the comprehensive direction of managers completely hidden from public view. Parents were given the illusion of being in touch with the people who now controlled much of their children's lives, but it was not so. Now let's go back to James Bryant Conant, the president of Harvard, who gave me my first clue about the actual purposes of forced schooling. In a book published in 1949 called The Child, the Parent, and the State, Conant stated flatly that our familiar dull schools were the result of a coup, a good coup, he thought. Now, when the president of Harvard makes a statement like that in print, there's a good chance that he knows what he's talking about. Isn't that so?
That was John Taylor Gatto and the first part of his October 2003 talk titled The Paradox of Extended Childhood. For the entire speech, thanks to Radio for Peace International. We'll hear more of this talk in subsequent editions of New World Notes. Thank you for listening. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. This program is available off the air by internet stream, podcast, or MP3 download at your convenience. All is free. For more information or to send feedback, start at http://newworldnotes.blogspot.com. The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily represent the views of anyone even remotely connected with this station. From Darkest New England, this is Kenneth Doust wishing you a good week and advising, illegitimi non carborundum, keep the faith, and please tune in again.